by shortwave, medium wave, satellite, and the internet. This is the Dutch International Service, Radio Netherlands. Media Network, a regular survey of communications developments produced and presented by Diana Jansen and Jonathan Marks.
Hello and welcome to a specially extended edition of Media Network as we kick off the new year 1998 with three quarters of an hour of information about international broadcasting. It's a very happy new year from both of us.
To both of you. I wonder who's listening on January the 1st. But let's not forget those who may have stumbled across this programme for the first time. Each Thursday, we look at how information crosses borders, mostly via shortwave radio, but also via the internet, and of course satellites as well. Way back in October of last year, we organised a big survey to try and find out what you think we should put into this programme, and what balance between traditional and new media. I'm pleased to say we had just over 1,000 survey forms returned.
And we think that's good, bearing in mind you couldn't win anything. The results will be tabulated this month, and then we'll get a better idea of the trends we should keep an eye on in the brand new year of 1998. As always, this programme relies on your feedback, and we regularly go to the polls, as it were, to check we're moving in the right direction.
In a few minutes, we'll have an in-depth survey into the shortwave receiver market, which you might want to record for future reference if you have a tape recorder handy.
In fact, we hope that in 1998, Media Network will be one of the productions moving off tape and assembled digitally instead. If you wander around our building at the moment, you'll see a lot more computer workstations than a few weeks back, as we start a major phase in our switch to digital. As a listener, we hope you won't hear an audible difference. But from a production point of view, we hope we can make the programme even more timely and find a way to export some of the special features into an archive on our website. At the moment, if you're looking for a feature we did on Latin America, you have to know we broadcast it on November the 6th last year. But, as with all major changes, the move has to be evolutionary rather than revolutionary.
And as some of our listeners are able to send us audio via the internet these days, we'll be using more of that technology to widen our contacts with you in this coming year. Once again, though, and we can't repeat this often enough, we still welcome your comments and questions via the ordinary snail mail, and we read every letter you send us. Now let's do some media news in brief, and we'll zip off down the medium wave band. We had just over 200 emails after last week's Christmas programme, most of them focusing on one event. Because of a satellite receiver breakdown in Belgium, most of the Christmas challenge didn't air on 1512 kHz via the transmitter of Radio Flandre Internationale. Sorry, it was beyond our control. But if you have internet access, then you can still check the online archive. Elsewhere on the dial, if you're within medium wave range of the Netherlands, you'll notice that channels carrying Hit Radio Veronica have just started carrying an announcement saying that because the inauguration of their FM network starts at 11 hours UTC, New Year's Day, they'll be leaving medium wave 15 days from now. Last chance to hear them then. The transmitter on 1224 kHz is still coming from the former offshore ship, the Communicator, still anchored at Trintelhaven, halfway along the dike between Enkhuizen and Lelystad. Veronica sold the channel to Quality Radio, the guys who took over from the Radio London project we covered in the programme, and they still operate from studios in a converted East German railway carriage parked at Zutphen railway station. Quality Radio want the AM frequency, and they want to revamp the transmitter, but they tell us it's unlikely they want to keep the communicator. They'll be moving onto land instead. The other Veronica channel, 828 kHz, from a 5 kilowatt transmitter near Rotterdam, has been given to the Hague-based broadcaster Arrow Classic Rock. Both Quality Radio and Arrow lost out in the new FM frequency distribution plan, which starts in Holland today. Commercial radio is getting expanded coverage, but they claim that public broadcasting has a lion's share of the spectrum. More on that discussion later on in January.
Media Network's Market Research Report. What's happening to the receiver industry around the world? We investigate what lies behind the truth.
Way back in 1980, Radio Netherlands started a series of consumer tests on shortwave receivers. We did so in response to a changing market. For in the 1970s, there was a trend in electronics magazines to build everything yourself. Indeed, buying something in a shop meant you'd opted for an easy way out and a vastly inferior product. Radio Netherlands broadcast a series of features explaining how you could enhance a basic receiver, adding an aerial tuning unit, or constructing a beat frequency oscillator. Remember all that? All to listen to certain utility stations between the broadcast bands. It was an era of do-it-yourself.
The technology of the 80s gradually killed the era of home construction. For a start, it became cheaper to buy your own receiver than try and build it yourself. The miniaturization of components made it impossible to take the back off a shortwave radio and poke around with a 30-watt soldering iron in an effort to fix a broken component. And as home computers appeared at the end of the 80s, so the electronics hobby shifted the emphasis from creating hardware to play around with new software.
In the 1970s, Radio Netherlands made a name for itself as a sort of electronics university of the airwaves. Courses written by Jim Vastenhout were given on this show's predecessor, DX Jukebox, and presented in 26 weekly parts.
The courses were successful and relevant in their day, but by the early 1980s, the number of shops selling individual components had dropped to a mere handful. It was also difficult to help someone thousands of kilometers away who had spent a month's salary on components, followed your instructions, but could not get the device to work properly.
So we switched to market research, looking at the better shortwave portables on the world market and putting them through our own independent test laboratory. Those tests are a mixture of hands-on experience and laboratory measurements using a standard procedure. Alongside the other tests that are published around the world, we believe that our contributions are still useful, at least judging by the hit count of the Real Radio part of the Radio Netherlands website, and the number of printed copies of the Receiver Shopping List Edition 15, which have gone out the door since it was completely revised in August of 1997.
As part of continuous research over the past few weeks, we've been calling just under 50 dealers around the world. We checked prices of receivers and asked them how business was doing. In August of 1996, we got the message that many dealers were in trouble, especially in Australasia and parts of the United States. Indeed, some of the best-known names are disappearing from the map. Gilfa Shortwave ceased trading earlier in 1997. An electronic equipment bank in Vienna, Virginia, has just announced it's ceasing its retail business at the end of February 1998 to concentrate on commercial and government clients instead.
A related company to EEB, called Edco, will continue to import shortwave receivers into the United States. Overall, though, we've bumped into a more positive message than 14 months ago, when we last called around in quite so much detail. Some of the dealers allowed us to record their comments. Others didn't want us to use the information on the air for commercial reasons. But the highlights you'll hear have been balanced to illustrate trends in general, not just those who agreed to be interviewed by Radio Netherlands.
Fred Osterman is president at Universal Radio in Reynoldsburg, Ohio, USA. Last time he was on the show, he said things were picking up slowly. As he closes the books for 1997, are things better than this time last year?
Well, it is, I'm happy to say. We did a sales marketing analysis for one of our vendors in Japan the other day, and we actually sat down and graphed our sales from roughly the last 15 years. And quite clearly, it built from the early 80s and peaked in 1992, and then it kind of gradually went down through 1996. But I'm happy to say that 1997 is clearly back on the upswing again. So I think we have reached bottom, and I believe we're on the way up again.
Fred says that there are many reasons for the upturn, not least that if you switch on a shortwave radio now, there are more stations to be found, and reception on higher frequencies is starting to improve.
We are now finally starting to enjoy improved propagation on shortwave. In other words, reception conditions are better. This is tied somewhat to the solar 11-year sunspot cycle, and we're starting to come out of the bottom of that. That's certainly a factor. And I also feel that a little bit of the newness of the internet is worn off, and a lot of folks that perhaps were enamored with that and busy with that for a few years have now started to come back to their listening hobby once again.
So where's the emphasis now?
Well, for us at Universal anyway, the strong markets continue to be portable shortwave radios, tabletop shortwave radios, and the weak markets for us are the scanner market and also for those shortwave listeners who listen to radio teletype. That's fallen off a bit in the last few years.
Bob Grove, who's president of a shortwave dealership called Grove Enterprises in Brasstown, North Carolina, also in the USA, reports a similar cautious recovery. He says that US legislation that might have outlawed scanner usage altogether has certainly affected the marketplace.
The beginning of 1997, for example, we had that horrendous subcommittee hearing, which many of us considered a travesty in Washington, D.C., in which it looked as though scanning in general was going to just be doomed. But there was a great hue and cry via the Internet primarily, in which tens of thousands of active consumers, even attorneys, business people, contacted and voiced their disapproval of that pending legislation, in which case it was withdrawn and replaced by a far more benign and enlightened piece of legislation, which has yet to go to full committee and will be introduced probably sometime after the first of the year. And it's far less ominous in terms of the future of scanning. So we feel much better about that. There's no doubt that the conditions, the band conditions, are improving from a shortwave standpoint, and that's good too. So I'd say that that the market had hit the bottom about a year ago and is slowly recovering.
The number of shortwave broadcast transmitters on the air is fairly stable. For although some Western broadcasters have cut back, new stations in the Middle East and Asia have signed on to take their place. That's not the case with point-to-point utility stations on shortwave, such as those used for maritime communications.
Let's say that the large installations of radio communications in that spectrum that were using various digital modes, single sideband for voice and so on, are now converting over to satellite, but they are still retaining their assets, since they already have such an enormous amount of money in them, as backup on HF. So where, for example, we might have been hearing a great deal of radio communications among military outposts and so on, and NASA communications, drug interdiction, this type of thing, before on HF as their primary communications, that is purely redundant now and is used as backup and going to secure modulation methods which cannot be monitored even when they're on HF.
And a trend like that must be extremely bad news if you make a living selling radios.
Interestingly enough, it would only be bad news, so far as we're concerned, if we saw a substantial decrease in the number of shortwave receivers which are sold. And we haven't sensed that. There's been a general decrease in both shortwave and scanners with time that we think we can probably ascribe to the Internet. What's happening there is I like to call the gee whiz factor, is gone. People are no longer fascinated with electronics like they were during the vacuum tube era, because we now live in a plug-and-play society. Once a person buys something that is going to operate for them, even if it's electronic, very few people care what's inside the box, just so long as the noise comes out the speaker.
We did quite a bit of phoning around in Europe. Some dealers were blunt that things were fine in the portable receiver market, rough when it comes to anything over the equivalent of $1,000. Comments from Martin Lynch were typical. He's sole owner and proprietor of Martin Lynch & Son of Ealing in London. He notes that computer-driven radios have suddenly sparked off interest.
I've noticed a decline over the last 3 or 4 years. Unfortunately, our shortwave receiver sales were very healthy, aided by the low HF 150 and the AOR 7030. In the last 2 years, they've been slowly declining and getting slower and slower. However, in the last 6 months, receiver sales and indeed HF transceiver sales have picked up tremendously. The ICOM PCR 1000 computer-based product, albeit isn't really a top-end receiver, again has rekindled interest. More and more of my customers, obviously, are PC-based, and the PCR 1000 is A, an excuse to spend money, and B, to have a system that's very up and new as a product. And that's created an awful lot of interest, albeit it isn't the normal type of receiver, of course.
10 years ago, shortwave broadcast listeners were seen as potential amateur radio enthusiasts. But there seems to have been a backlash from those who had no ambition to pass an exam so they could talk back.
These days, amateur radio is flat at best, with just as many new people coming in as leaving. Martin Lynch says a strong pound has helped customers in Britain.
With the internet, of course, there appears to be a lot more for them to do. They can actually now talk to people, exchange video and everything else. So it's an uphill struggle. It's a battle for us. And I'm pleased to say the Japanese and other markets are responding with lower prices on product and more interesting features to keep the whole hobby alive and going.
What's the balance in terms of the type of receivers sold? I say that because if you talk to people in North America, you find that the home-based product, as it were, the Drakes, are doing quite well, whereas they find that the sets out of Europe are quite expensive. What about in the UK?
Okay, in the UK, the AOR 7030 is still a very good receiver. Kenwood, unfortunately, with the R5000, as excellent a receiver as it is still very old. There is no indication from Kenwood that they're going to produce another receiver. The HF150 low have just reduced the price greatly to aid sales and in fact increase the specification to make a Europa type version of the HF150, but certainly the Icon PCR1000 is creating enormous interest to the stage that there's a massive backlog literally for our own company on that product.
Elsewhere in the UK it's a similar upbeat story. The exchange rate and better conditions are good news for Peter Waters, one of the directors of Waters and Stanton, a major radio dealership based in Hockley in Essex.
I would say that we have noticed a slight increase, and I think that we are expecting the trend to continue, probably in a steeper curve, because, as you rightly say, conditions. I think it'll take a little while to leak through to particularly to newcomers how different conditions can be in the bad years compared with the good years.
Waters says the reason some dealers are seeing a slump is because they have ignored the portables. Some newcomers never find out there is such a thing as a tabletop shortwave receiver.
Yeah, I'd say portables are more popular now than they were 5 years ago, and I think that is a direct result of the performance of the portables being a lot better. I mean, portables a few years ago were very sort of mediocre. They're okay for the stronger broadcast stations, but they had terrible front ends and they were no good for single sideband. But I think some of the Sony models now have got performances which are akin to what some of the base station receivers were 5 or 6 years ago.
But there's some discussion as to whether people want to listen to more and more parts of the spectrum all on one receiver. At Radio Netherlands, we've always said it was better to have a radio that has good performance on one part of the dial than a receiver that picks up, let's say, from DC to daylight and suffers from signal overload as a result. Waters agrees that the increase in wideband scanner listening is dropping.
If anything, that acceleration is now falling off quite a bit. The reason being, of course, that a lot of the services that they once listened to are now starting to go digital. And so that is going to actually decelerate the sales of these wideband receivers quite markedly over the next few years, I think, because there will be less services to listen to.
But contrast that with experiences from Martin Lynch, who says wideband is definitely the future.
We don't often have only broadcast shortwave listener requests. They want more features, more band to listen to, especially up in the VHF and UHF spectrums as part of the package. They don't just want a shortwave receiver, which is a pity.
Those UK dealers with internet connections have discovered a deluge of questions coming in over the web.
Almost since we started, we've traded internationally. Our website is very, very important to us. We pride ourselves in having the latest release products on there, certainly as quick or as quicker than anybody else. Our email system linked to the internet receives up to 100, 150 emails a day. A lot of them are requests from catalogues from unknown countries, but it is very, very healthy for business, and we enjoy that part of the system. I will admit we will not send catalogues out to very far away places, mainly because of the costs involved, but we do respond to every email.
Let's go now back across the Atlantic and head north. Jack Summers is a sales manager for Norham Radio Incorporated in North York, Ontario, Canada. He says the amateur radio market there is stronger than the broadcast listener market. Today's users are appliance users. They want to buy it, take it home, and plug it in. They don't care how it works, as long as it does so. If all else fails, they may read the instruction manual.
It's six of one, half a dozen of the other. A lot of the shortwave crowd is an uneducated crowd. So when the signals went away because of the low spots in the propagation, probably 25% of them asked why, and the other 75% figured that there was some other reason why. You know, on a daily basis, you educate people, and the bands are coming back, then there is renewed interest, yes. 3-4 years, and you're finding people upgrading, especially as technology changes.
Scanner sales in Canada are boosted by the fact that cellular phone coverage on scanners is not blocked, and there's quite a bit of cross-border sales into the US where there are restrictions on what's allowed.
Mario Boisvert is a salesman for Atlantic Ham Radio in Ontario, Canada. He says the internet is an enemy, not a friend.
Well, it keeps going down and down because of the internet, and it doesn't get better. I don't think it's going to come back to what it was a couple of years ago. However, you know, there's some better conditions coming up soon, so things should improve in the next 2 years. Amateur radio actually is not as bad, but it's going down too, because it's easier on the internet to talk to someone in Japan, for example, than you know, buying a ham radio. You have to get the license and everything, so it's easier on the internet. But there will always be some people interested in amateur radio, because the feeling you get when you go into amateur radio, like on the radio, for example, and you talk to someone in Russia, you know, there's no wires, nothing at all. It's just your made-up antenna, you know, homemade antenna, and the internet is too easy, so you cannot be as proud on the internet.
Bit like being able to dial a phone. You don't need a physics degree in order to use it.
Mind you, there's a lobby of opinion that says that the falling numbers in the amateur radio circles are partly because getting a license to transmit may be too hard. As well as the theory, many countries still require you to pass an exam in Morse code. Now that Morse is no longer as vital as it used to be in utility and military circles, you could argue it's time to review how relevant it is to amateur radio. Some operators believe a Morse test separates the men from the boys. Some dealers believe this in turn means the group becomes so exclusive it's no longer large enough to make it commercially viable. The debate continues.
Jack Doubley owns a store on Davie Street in Vancouver, Canada. We asked him to analyse the market in British Columbia. Are things picking up or bumping along the bottom?
Well, reception in general, of course, is still, as you put it, bumping along. Western Canada here is sort of on the edge of the earth before we fall off. Pacific Rim is actually coming in not too badly. As far as sales of shortwave radio in general, we're noticing that we have very good sales in the portable market, although our tabletops have pretty much come to a grinding halt. Partly because of the dollar figure, and I guess the cost of tabletop radios have started to escalate to the point where they're getting a little out of reach for a lot of people. The other thing, too, is that as a whole, I think people are spending their time either on the internet or they have lack of time period to spend on hobbies. We ourselves sell other things other than just shortwave radios. We also sell scanners as well. Our lower price scanners have pretty much gone away because of competition from one of the chain stores, although we are selling a lot of higher end products, but most of the products we're selling is around about the $600 range. So anything up to about $1,000 Canadian is still within the reach of the average consumer, or anything over that has pretty much come to a slow right down to a halt.
Jack says he's pleased that some manufacturers have reacted in the right way, looking seriously at what people need in a tabletop receiver. Most shortwave listeners are not going to dig out weak stations from the static, at least not on day one. He still expects to be selling shortwave radios 5 years from now.
Oh, I sure hope so. We're starting to see some of the manufacturers like Drake and Lowe, for instance, coming out with medium-priced radios around the $500, $700 range. And although they haven't started taking off yet, there are definitely some interest in some tabletops. But the Sony company, of course, is still producing quite a number of radios in the right price point, and we can still make a reasonable dollar on them. What we are now finding ourselves, because we are heavily involved in other forms of communication, that cellular phones and PCS, of course, is taking a dramatic part of our business at the present time. Personal communication services is a term they use in North America for basically digital cellular phones.
Right now, there's clearly a growing interest on a mass scale in personal communications. Look at the millions of any currency being spent on advertising for pagers and portable telephones. But other stores catering to different pastimes are also suffering from the fact that many people devote less time to one particular interest. They zap, just like they zap channels on a television.
From talking to other retailers and sort of friends in the industry and other industries, people just don't have the time to spend as much anymore. I'm a perfect example. I've got a young family and a house, and when I go home from my downtown store, gotta get the kids to bed and get books read to them, and by the time you have time to settle down, I don't really like watching TV. I don't have much time to listen to the radio. I very seldom have time to read books. I'm doing my other hobbies of either working on my bicycles or doing other things or even working around the house, and next thing you know, it's bedtime. So the time restraints on people these days, I think, is really causing a lot of the problem.
Price is another factor too. In Europe, the strong dollar means that equipment from the US manufacturer of Drake is rather expensive compared to sets made in the UK. In Canada, the situation is reversed.
I'll give you some examples of what the products are selling for in North America. A Sony ICF 2010, for instance, now is retailing for $649 Canadian, and that's a fair price. The new Drake R8B, I just ordered one today from Drake Canada, and we'll be selling it to a customer for about pretty close to $1,900. I think it's $1,879, for instance, for a Drake R8B in Canadian dollars. Now, Canada, my understanding-wise, is not too bad pricing for shortwave radio because it is duty-free to bring shortwave radio products into Canada. Although, I guess the biggest thing as far as the Drakes are concerned, we used to sell a lot of Drake R8s, let's say 2-3 years ago. We would sell approximately 1.5 per month on a retail one-store location basis. Where when the R8As came out, that's also when the net started getting much more popular. And I think that was part of what drove the sales down. We would maybe sell 2 or 3 a year. So there's a dramatic downturn in the sales of those particular radios.
Jack says that in contrast, the second-hand market, or pre-owned, to use the new jargon, has dramatically increased in the last 4 months. And for every high-end tabletop sold, 100 portables go out of the same door.
Radio Netherlands has been testing radios for well over 16 years. Our independent examinations are trusted by listeners around the world. Now, read the results of the latest round of tests in the 15th edition of Radio Netherlands Receiver Shopping List. Best of all, the advice is free. And it's now online via the internet. Don't enter a store without it.
I suppose it's 17 years now, as from today. Some manufacturers, such as Grundig, report that most of their sales of low-end portables are through airline and mail-order catalogues, as well as the collectible stores like Sharper Image, full of the products to solve problems you didn't even know you had. Design and price play a more important role there than how useful the device will be once you get it home.
Martin Lubbock and David Freeman in the UK both sent us faxes recently complaining about their treatment by salesmen in different electronic shops in the UK.
Martin says he tried to buy a portable set in a high street photo chain in Colchester in the east of England. The fluorescent lights made it impossible to pick up anything inside the shop, and the salesman refused to accompany outside so he could listen to it for a few minutes away from the interference. Martin says he felt he was pressurised to either take it or leave it, and the advice he got from the salesman about getting more information about international broadcasting turned out to be a complete bit of nonsense. His local amateur radio club was definitely not the place to ask for advice on broadcasting matters.
David Freeman had a similar experience in Newcastle, up in the north of England. He comments that the radio he was interested in cost in the region of $1,000.
I think that's a pretty heavy investment, and you would expect the shop owners to at least have some clue as to what the radio could be used for. I concluded that none of the sales force had ever switched on a radio for pleasure, and that they regarded people that did so as a bit strange. Home computing would have quickly collapsed if PCs had been sold in such an offhand fashion.
Dorothy Andrews of Hong Kong sent us an email last week. She works as a consultant and a translator for a computer chip manufacturer, and uses shortwave to keep in touch with her native New Zealand, as well as dipping into news and current affairs beamed from stations in Europe. She comments,
"In this part of Asia, you have to bargain for everything. That's fine if you know what something's really worth, and the salespeople love haggling. I usually offer half of what's being asked and work up from there. Usually they want between 70 and 85% of what they originally claimed was the price. I don't have a problem finding the average price for personal computers, but you have to hunt around to find stores selling good quality WorldBand portables. A lot of the inexpensive stuff is made in southern China. Looks great on the outside, but just produces whistles instead of clear reception. I used your receiver price guide on the Radio Netherlands website to get average retail prices on 3 radios before I went out to buy a new set. The old one stopped working because the batteries exploded in the heat and the chemical ooze corroded the insides completely. Even after heavy bargaining here in Hong Kong, I found the prices here to be above those in the U.S. Independent advice was non-existent, and I had to make sure that power supplies and a roll-up antenna were packed in the box with a radio, or I would have been forced to pay extra again.
Let's move down under to Australia, where Media Network correspondent Mike Burt in Melbourne has also been doing some research out in the blazing hot sun. The market for shortwave receivers, especially tabletop sets, is said to be very slow. Mike, looking at the prices in magazines from your part of the world, it looks like everything is very expensive.
Yes, import duty and sales tax accounts for about 30%, and then you've got freight. So you're looking at 30 to 32% before the radio hits the shops.
So what sorts of prices are you being forced to pay?
Well, portables are reasonable. The Sanjin 909 and the Grundig Yachtboy 400 sell for about $400 here, which is roughly about £230. But when you get into the tabletop receivers, the cheapest Sirius receiver is the Yaesu FRG100. Now, that's exactly $1,000, which is about £550. Then you go, say, to the AOR 7030, which is $1,950, which is about £1,000. And then there's the ICOM R8500, which is retail price of $3,700. Now, I don't know what that is in sterling, but it's very expensive.
Indeed it is. And it's certainly more than you would pay for a multimedia personal computer, isn't it?
That's right. I've just recently bought a new PC, a P166, with 32 megabytes of RAM and 2 gigabytes of hard drive, and it cost me $1,300.
Mike says there's also a thriving second-hand market for used tabletop receivers in Australia at the moment.
Not far away from Mike, we find Ross Keogh, manager of Strictly Ham and Bayswater, that's near Melbourne in Australia. He says that portables have taken over from the tabletops. So how's business in general?
Well, you hear conflicting reports. As far as my business goes, shortwave is quite big. There is quite a lot of shortwave listeners here, and although I do sell many desktop-type versions at the top end of the market, I would probably sell 4-1 with the handheld type as opposed to the desktop. But I think there'll always be a market for the high-end equipment, of course. You know, the biggest influence on anyone purchasing anything is basically the price.
Ross's one-man store has been open for the last 4.5 years. He says customers demand that salesmen know what they're selling before they part with their money. Now there's been talk that the PC and the television may combine by early next century. What about the PC and shortwave radio?
There's a couple of those around. There's one in the States currently, and of course there's Wind Radio. I've used Wind Radio, and it seems to work okay, but I think that as technology improves, I think that's the way they'll go, because it's so much easier to, you know, just slot a card into a computer, as where a lot of people wouldn't probably want to, you know, run the outboard box plugged into the computer. You know, it's easier to have everything in the one box.
We continue on our New Year survey by going to Brian Clark in Auckland, New Zealand. Brian, is it a similar story with high import duty in your part of the Pacific?
No, Jonathan. We're very fortunate in New Zealand. There is almost no sales tax on such equipment. But unfortunately, the prices are still far too high, in my opinion. I think a number of hobbyists that I know have, in fact, ordered equipment by mail order from the United States and effectively got a better price, including the various charges pertaining to bringing the receiver in from the States, have actually had a better price than buying at retail in New Zealand.
So what distinguishes the better dealer from the rest? Hugh Catman in Florida, USA, sent this message, which probably sums it up.
Wouldn't it be nice if shortwave dealers had a serious spring clean in 1998? Many of the electronic stores I visited in this area recently look like the owners, well, don't really care. They should trash the theory books that have been sitting on their shelves for years and make sure international broadcasting is presented as a new challenge. An internet terminal on the sales counter would allow them to offer more topical information to the curious customer. And best of all, some of the guys in the shop might even get enthused and start listening themselves. If shortwave needs a boost, it has to start with the dealers knowing more and sharing more. Those that got the message are already seeing an upturn in interest.
Hear, hear. Last but not least, maybe the information about decent antennas to go with the radio would be useful as well. Fred Osterman has the final word on that one.
Well, that is true. It's rather bizarre, but some people will drop $1,000 on a receiver and then they'll spend $15 for a piece of wire and think that they have a system. Now, this person would never go out and buy a large TV and throw rabbit ears on it. That would never happen, but people do spend $1,000 and then spend nothing on the antenna.
And that's another story. Well, that's where we leave our survey for the moment, but your reactions, of course, are always welcome. And behind the scenes, over the Christmas holidays, we've been testing a range of cheaper portable receivers, concentrating on their suitability for the traveller. In the course of January, we'll be sorting out the results, and you'll be able to check out the details on our website in early March.
In the meantime, don't forget that the receiver shopping list is on the web, and it's continuously updated as we review receivers here on Media Network. It's all in the Real Radio section, which you'll find signposted on our homepage.
Don't worry if you miss something today, as you'll hear it later from some other station.
And now, because of today's extended edition of Media Network, we've still got time to bring up another line to the outside world. And we'll connect up with Lou Josephs in Washington, D.C., who monitors internet developments for us. Lou, in the course of 1997, we saw two companies talk about a small device you could hold in your hand and somehow pump full of audio from the internet. Do you think it likely that others will follow the same idea in 1998?
Yes, Deanna, I think it is. Sony has copyrighted and trademarked the name Netman. And as we know, Sony is an expert at miniaturizing electronics. If we look at what they've done in the shortwave field and also in the portable cassette player field, what this product will be is anybody's guess, but the name Netman surely indicates it's going to have some kind of internet connection.
Indeed, it does. But there have been several tests here in Europe, too, of putting streaming audio over existing FM subcarriers or via DAB. That could also be a narrowcaster's dream.
That's a possibility, but no one really has spent the time or the energy yet to go into that field.
Mind you, the hype surrounding the internet can be its own worst enemy, because amongst the euphoria, you don't hear the stories about companies that have failed in 1997. Even trend-setting magazines like Wired in San Francisco have been forced to lay people off.
Well, no. People are taking a long, hard look at what they've done on the internet, and they have, in some cases, accomplished a better customer service, B, the ability to buy things over the web, and C, the illustrated brochure. But what your return on investment has been has not been that spectacular, except for a few firms who have the right idea, like Amazon.com and books, like the Wall Street Journal and Financial Information, and I think we're going to see more ventures along the lines of some of the stuff that started out last couple of years fold in the new year.
And what about the much-publicized combination of a television and a web connection, the so-called web TV? How is that done during the holiday season over there?
So far, web TV's new enhanced version really didn't hit the stores in time for the holiday sales. And the current version of web TV was heavily discounted to get it out of the stores, and it appears it didn't move because people don't want their web TV just yet.
Well, in Europe, it didn't even turn up as promised in 97. But on the non-profit side of things, I must confess that with over a million hits a month to our website now, we're quite pleased with a growing loyal following to www.rnw.nl. But Lou, if you could make three technical wishes for 1998, what would they be?
Wish number one, a state-of-the-art shortwave radio that would be web-enabled for the software so that it could be run off computer, that it would have state-of-the-art digital signal processing, and it would have the opportunity to be upgraded, whether it was either a card or a circuit board, so that when digital comes of age on the shortwave medium, it would be able to receive it. And be at an affordable price.
Whoa, sounds like a very big wish number one to me. It's got sub-wishes already. But Luke, continue.
Wish number two, that the major browser manufacturers, Microsoft, Netscape, and let's say for the sake of argument, the organization out of Norway that are putting out the Opera browser, can all get together and agree on a standard for HTML4 and what's called extensible markup language, so that you don't have to switch back and forth between browsers when you're viewing a website, that all browsers will work on the web the same way. It's basically what's called the interoperability pledge, and very few people from a design standpoint have taken it. Wish number three, people who are looking at the internet as a technology don't look at it as a threat, but they look at it as an add-on to existing media. What's happening within the next 2 to 3 years in the internet, based on figures that I've seen from research studies, shows that in the developed world, the internet is becoming a mass media, not unlike radio, television, or newspapers and magazines. Once you realize that it's no different than radio, then it's newspaper enhanced, that it's television enhanced, you have an interesting medium on which to do a lot of work.
I hope your wishes come true. Thanks, Lou.
Andy Sennett joins us now with what's probably the world's first media news report of 1998, and we start in South America.
Yes, because today sees the start of relay transmissions from HCJB in Ecuador via transmitters in the UK. Some listeners will recall that the shortwave transmitters in Britain are now operated by a private company, Merlin Communications International, and they're allowed to sell spare airtime. Now, this arrangement involves transmissions to the Middle East and the former Soviet Union, areas difficult to reach from HCJB's own transmitter site in Ecuador. The schedule is 17 to 18 hours UTC on 7175 kHz in Uzbek and Tajik, 18 to 19 hours on 6150 kHz in Russian, and 21 to 22 hours on 6090 kHz in Arabic.
HCJB is a religious station based in Quito, and as you may know, their local transmitter site, just outside the capital, may have to be knocked down in the coming years. OK, we've been getting a lot of email recently from the Free Nigeria movement about their radio station, the Voice of Free Nigeria.
Yes, I've got quite a lot of email from them, but the salient point is that they've changed their frequency. The broadcast is still on the air every Saturday from 19 to 20 hours UTC, but the frequency has changed from 11715 to 11645 kHz. That's 11645.
Now to a station in Asia that isn't reported very often.
That's right. Radio Pilipinas is the external service of the Philippines and broadcasts via Voice of America transmitters in that country. Our colleagues at BBC Monitoring recently published the current schedule, from which I see that their English transmission is at 7:30 to 19:30 UTC, on 15190, 11890, and 11730 kHz. It's beamed to the Middle East, where there are many Filipino workers. But I have to admit, Jonathan, this is one station I've never heard.
Well, I have heard it, but only on a tape. So let's make a New Year's resolution to try and log it in 1998.
Is there still time to make resolutions? Well, anyway, hopefully I will hear it. And another station I've never heard, but will be listening out for, is Australian Defence Forces Radio. And according to a message sent by this station to Cumbre DX, they've added a second frequency to the existing 13525. Try for them between 0430 and 0630 UTC on or around 15707 kHz, 15707.
That really is a peculiar frequency. Thanks, Andy. One more item to squeeze in. It seems that the UK authorities have decided not to allow bids for the long-wave frequency of 225 kHz. Last year, we thought it might become available. So it looks like two potential groups who are after the channel will start the new year a little bit disappointed.
Radio Netherlands, where great minds drink alike. Sorry, think alike.
And that must be a cue for Mike Burt. Indeed, he's back now to put the finishing touches on the first media network for the new year. First, Mike, give us an update on the ordinary weather in Melbourne. What's it like at the moment?
The weather's very nice today. It's about 30 degrees, but tomorrow, Deanna, it's going to be about 37 degrees, so that'll be a bit too hot for me.
Okay, now to the propagation, and we start with a review of the past 7 days.
The sun was quiet except for a C2 solar flare and coronal mass ejection last Thursday, peaking at 5:57 UTC. The solar flux ranged between 108 and 96. The average works out to 103, which equals an effective sunspot number of 52, and that's up 15 points on the previous week's figure. The geomagnetic field disturbance indicator, the estimated planetary A index, ranged between 1 and 22, which represents quiet to active thresholds. The magnetic field was generally quiet all week except on Tuesday, when the solar flare and coronal mass ejection we experienced last Thursday pushed the magnetic field to active levels at times.
And what about between now and next Thursday, January the 8th?
IPS Radio and Space Services expects solar activity will remain low. The geomagnetic field should also remain quiet with maybe a slight dash of unsettled at times. So that's it, and a happy new year to you and all your listeners.
Thanks, Mike. And that's all for now.
Yes, we've got to get used to saying 1998. Still, there's plenty of time to do so. We hope you'll be around next week when we'll have the regular half-hour format of the show. In the meantime, from the team around the world, and Deanna and myself here in Hilversum,
have a sunny weekend.
Media Network is a Radio Netherlands presentation. Copyright 1998. So don't rip us off. We know you are. Everything's digital now. We got your number, pal.